And we've got our Gary Patterson with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We're opening up the phone lines, music questions, mysteries on Coast to Coast AM. Gary, how is Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses doing?
It's doing well, and it's also on Kindle. So, you know, you can download it on your Kindle and watch it now. So if you enjoy these stories, we have them. Also, there's a DVD of 16 of the stories that should be available on my website.
So do you have a favorite story, favorite myth story?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many of them. I mean, I love the stuff about Lennon, the number 9. I love the Robert Johnson tie-ins, the number of rock stars who died at 27. What was funny, when they flew me to New York to do Doomed to Die 13 Curses, which is still playing on E, those were some of the stories they wanted to hear, and along with some movie curses, which I thought were very interesting. So, I mean, I enjoy doing that. Maybe, George, we can get a series doing stuff like this. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I got to tell you, that is my one of my favorite myths and legends, the 27.
How do you explain it? I mean, after doing the show, our good friend Ian sent me an email from a student who's performing. We're trying to get his PhD right now. And he did a study where he took the age of all rock stars. And I mean, we're talking about 17 years old with Ritchie Valens all the way up through their 60s and 70s when they died. And he gave me the printout, and over 40-something rock stars died at the age of 27, more than any other age. 27 is the number one age that rock stars die. And I know you can say, well, it could be because of the drug usage. It could be their means of travel. Yeah, but I could have said, well, let's say rock stars up to the age of 30. And I tried to just be very specific and only use that age. I didn't bring in Otis Redding, who was in his 27th year. It was only 27. And Glennis did a great job on the numerology with it. And, I mean, that is one of the stories that I know a lot of rock stars listen, because I was reading an interview with BMI on John Mayer. And he said, well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm glad I'm past 27.
Isn't that amazing?
They listen. It is.
Now, and how old was Heath Ledger when he died, the actor?
Well, I think he was over 27, I think. Either that or much younger. I know that one of the shows they did.
He was 29 years old.
29. I thought.
Actually, he was 28, mm-hmm. but he was going to be 29. That's unbelievable. I mean, look how close it is.
And I mean, I pick up on stuff like that. Like when Morgan Freeman had his auto accident, I've been to Morgan Freeman's club in Clarksdale, Mississippi, Ground Zero. And I was thinking, oh, my gosh, I hope Morgan Freeman wasn't injured on Highway 61, you know, at the crossroads thing. And that's the first thing I thought of. And his accident occurred on Highway 32, and thank God he's all right. But, I mean, those things just happen, and they just pop into your head, I guess, when you research it as much as I have.
You know, Morgan's like me, where he spends a lot of time between that area in Los Angeles. Well, I'm the same way between Los Angeles and St. Louis. And I had just seen him in L.A. 2 weeks before his auto crash. And, you know, you forget that they have this other life about them. I mean, I've got my family in St. Louis. My kids are here, my grandchildren. And, you know, when you're here, it's a different kind of lifestyle for you. And then I go back to L.A., which I'm going to be back on Monday. You know, you've got that different kind of lifestyle again, and people seem to forget that, Gary.
Oh, they do. And I can tell you there's a major difference when I'm in L.A. or New York from where I'm in East Tennessee. So it's a major difference. Sometimes home is a restful place, and your business world, you know, where you have to go for business, is L.A. and New York in this industry.
Absolutely. But it does get cold in St. Louis
lately. Oh, my gosh. Also, let me tell you.
Birmingham, Alabama, we go east to the Rockies. David, you're on with us. Hey, Dave.
Hey, what's going on?
All is well, my friend.
Oh, yeah. I got a question for Gary.
Okay.
I saw this on TV about, I guess, sometime in the last 12 months. And I think I want to say that it was the new show that comes on TV Land. They're doing this thing, you know, myths, legends, you know, is it real, is it fake?
Right.
You know, the show. They had a segment on about Oprah Winfrey and Elvis Presley being first cousins, and that Vernon Tsai, the family, hid this, you know, from Elvis, from his immediate side of the family. And they gave all this genealogy, tracing back how the Winfreys and the Presleys were actually related through, like, birth certificates, through marriage licenses, and I just wanted to see what you knew about it, and if there is any factual information to it being true.
Well,
because they are from the same area in Mississippi. The place where Oprah Winfrey grew up is about 25 to 30 miles from where Elvis Presley grew up in Tupelo.
Well, now you're going to have to help me with this, but didn't this go back to North Carolina?
Something about Oprah Winfrey's family started out being slaves,
right.
and then after they won freedom from slavery, that they migrated somehow to Mississippi.
Exactly, and it's more like a Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings story, because I think the premise was that slave owners often had children with their slaves, and that's why you had the ability that to trace the family line. But I think that they also said that Elvis would have been very proud to have had Oprah as a cousin, and maybe she would have been very proud to have Elvis. But there is a story, and obviously they've got some genealogy that goes back with it, and maybe that's another DNA test coming up for another show. Who knows?
What are you working on now, Gary?
Well, actually, gosh, I've got a couple of good things. There's a company in Canada that I'm talking to about an animated film, and it involves a major super band. So we'll see how that happens before I say anything about it. But it's always fun, and I'm always collecting new stories. And I know Simon & Schuster wants me to get back and get him a new book, and I've got to do that this summer. So I'm trying that again. But you know how it is doing TV and film and everything else. You just really run out of time.
Well, absolutely. You know, after you and I had talked about the Richie Valens plane and the pilot, remember you talking about the bullet in the seat? We almost had an opportunity to get the pilot. That came very, very close. But, God, those were great music days, weren't they, Gary, in those days?
Well, it was the beginning of rock and roll. Everything was fresh and everything was new. And, you know, to talk about Elvis's influence, I mean, Buddy Holly went to see Elvis in Texas in Lubbock. And Buddy was going to be a country star. But after he saw Elvis's effect on the girls, Buddy knew it was time to be a rock and roll star. And, you know, the whole thing about, you know, the thing about the seat, Roger Peterson was a pilot. He was killed in the plane crash. And Jerry Dwyer owns the plane. And I've heard the plane is still in a warehouse. So it's still there. It would be a great story to get that. And here's the question I have with the bullet seat. The only autopsy that was performed on any of the musicians, any of the people in that plane, was on the pilot. And to me, if there was a bullet that had gone through the seat, it seems to me that in an autopsy on the pilot, they would have found it. And, you know, we had J.P. Richardson Jr., the Big Bopper Jr., on talking about all the myths with that. Yeah. That was a great show and a lot of fun.
Next up, let's go to Larry in San Francisco, west of the Rockies. Larry, go ahead.
Yeah, another Elvis question for Gary. This is actually kind of related to the last call. You know how they always talk about that Elvis stole the music of African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to put out was maybe he didn't steal it. Maybe he had a right to it because he was black. Now. I got this idea from Grail Marcus in his book Mystery Train. He doesn't directly say that Elvis is black, but he said he kind of says he has a black soul, that he hung around the black side of Memphis and in high school dated black girls, which is very unusual in that age. But when I did some research on that, I found that his Elvis' genealogy, I found his mother's always referred to as being Creole. Now, Creole has more than one meaning, but certainly one of the meanings of it in the South is being part black. So you were talking about being related to Oprah through his father's side, but maybe he was also part black through his mother's side.
Hmm.
That sounds interesting. I tell you, there's so much thing about Elvis. I mean, he had Jewish blood, he had Christian blood. He wore the Star of David and all this because he didn't want to get out of going to heaven on technicalities, as Corey said. So, you know, he was a mixture of everything. But you know, I think people need to realize that who condemn Elvis for stealing black music. I mean, he was able, with his music and his performances, to put a spotlight on black artists and get them on the radio.
Well, and what do you mean by steal music? I mean, can't you emulate someone, copy them? What's wrong with that?
The only thing wrong with it is if you ever listen to Pat Boone do Little Richard songs, you know, when Little Richard wrote Tutti Frutti, Pat Boone did a version, and it just didn't have that sound. So a lot of black artists were thinking that they were writing the songs, they were getting a penny, a copy, as a copyright, and the white artists were hitting the major radio play, and as obviously the more radio play you have, more money you make, but it also made money for Little Richard, but his contract was structured differently. So they were saying that Elvis never would have existed, never would have been popular if he hadn't taken black artists to you know, fulfill his destiny. But that was very short-sighted, because Elvis actually turned the spotlight, and with music and R&B, they gained in prominence, and black records were played on white radio stations, and we have what's now the greatest rock and roll experiences of our life, George, because we lived it.
Absolutely. I remember seeing Chuck Berry in concert, and I met him, by the way, back in 1985, and he's a remarkable guy.
Oh, he is. I mean, he's probably the greatest lyricist in rock and roll. I mean, he can stand up at a microphone and start putting out lyrics. You know,
still, what is he now? He's got to be 80-something.
Well, he does. And, you know, he's from St. Louis. He's from the same area.
I know what. I used to run into him all the time.
I heard a person told me the story that there was a casino he was at in St. Louis somewhere. And all at once, the bells and whistles went off on a slot machine, and he turned around and he said, here was this 80-year-old man doing the duck walk. You know, like he was Chuck Berry. He'd won at the slot machines. I think that's a pretty funny story.
That is cool. Kenny in Memphis, Tennessee, you're up with us. First-time caller. Hi, Kenny.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I'm so glad to get through to the line or whatever and speak to you guys. Wow, I don't know where to begin after all this. Well, first of all, our prayers go out to George Klein, you know, who was involved in the a wreck, you know, a couple of nights ago. But he's doing fine.
Good.
Yeah. And I don't really have a question as I do some of my experiences with the, you know, Elvis connection, I guess you may call it, or whatever. Let's see, I was 21 years old when he passed, so it had to be the year before that, 1976. I was trying to get into the music business myself, and I finally made a connection with a producer, somebody at the studio. Do you remember that recording studio that was on South Highland right next to the radio station?
Yeah, but I can't remember the name of the studio.
Yeah, exactly, and I think they've torn it down. But anyway, it was 1976, and we all were there waiting on Elvis to show up, and he never showed up. One of the band members said he must be somewhere getting high.
And, really? Because they knew him, right?
Oh, yeah, they knew him, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You remember in the movie Walk the Line?
Yes.
The Johnny Cash movie? They were giving Johnny Cash amphetamines. They say, Elvis takes them. He shakes his head in the movie, you know, because I think that a lot of this, as far as amphetamines and all this, you had these grueling road tours where you had to play. It kept you awake. It gave you energy. And I think that that's probably how it started with him.
It hit them all eventually, didn't it?
It did.
Let's go to Toledo, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Jason, your turn. Hi, Jason.
Hey, George. Hey, Gary.
Hey, how are you?
I got to say, Gary, I've always wanted to call in and ask you these two questions.
So okay, I hope I know the answer.
I'm just ecstatic that I finally got the chance. First off, I know you wrote the book, The Walrus is Paul.
Yes.
And, you know, I know a lot of people write books based on theories, you mm-hmm. know, that they have facts that they believe in. I've always just wanted to ask you if you really believe that Paul McCartney is dead. I mean, I'm on the fence. I love your book.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, no problem, brother. I just always wanted to ask you personally if you believe that or if that's just, you know, something good to write a book about.
Well, I wrote the book because it was not a book on the topic at the time. And I love the story because I grew up with it. Now, let's take it in two elements. First of all, in 1969, when this happened, I happened to be right out of high school. And I would have told you, I would have been convinced at that time that something was wrong, that, you know, the Beatles hadn't performed since 1966. They turned down all kinds of offers to make, you know, music and mm-hmm. great concert tours. But when I found the message on the bass drum that said 1190 die, and the two ones make 11 and 9, and then it told me the Beatles had actually put something in there. This was not people's imaginations. And, of course, I found that when I was, you know, researching the book and doing that. So it told me the Beatles did this, whether to sell records or whatever. But I can tell you that after the years of writing it, I try to keep the book, as you know, I try to keep it not judgmental. I try not to tell you the answer. I try to lead you to maybe three distinct ways that you can see it and find it for yourself. But since I've met people close to the Beatles and know a lot more about it now, then I tend to think that McCartney's with us, because if you think, if Paul had died in 66, who wrote the second side of Abbey Road? Who wrote Live and Let Die? I mean, there's some great music that Paul McCartney's written after, you know, the date of supposedly his death at 66. So, you know, I hate to break everybody's heart and sit there and say, well, you know, there could be, well, and there could be an opportunity. You know, nobody's ever going to know for sure, because George and I did a show on this and pictures that didn't match. I mean, it took a lot. I had to go to the TBI and actually ask them questions about, you know, the faces that didn't match. But it's fascinating. And urban legends, what makes it fun is for a new generation to discover them. And that's what I hope. And I will tell you this. I would like to know any of the clues I missed, because that would be fascinating for me. But I sort of, if Paul McCartney called me and said, Gary, let me tell you, we did this for this reason, it would break my heart, because what I'd like the legend to live forever. I'd like a new generation to get it. And that's the fun of the whole thing, and the power of the music.
Gary, has anybody ever asked Paul McCartney about this? Because I remember, too, in my youth, that, you know, you would play a song backwards, you know, and you could hear, I buried Paul.
Oh, well,
stuff
exactly.
Like that. I mean, did anybody ever say, Paul, what was this stuff?
Oh, well, they did. They did. And I've got an interview in the 1980s in Chicago, and it went back with the title of The Walrus. And they said, and McCartney was saying, well, I'm really not Paul, I'm his double, remember? And, you know, he said that as a joke. But then, you know, what's kind of interesting is that in the Life magazine article that came out in 69 that said Paul is still with us, there's a scene in an article where Paul said, look, it was John in Black. He was the walrus on the Sergeant Pepper, or the Magical Mystery Tour album. And then in 1980, he says, no, I was the walrus. I just picked up this walrus head and put it on. So it's like a lot of revisionism with it. But, you know, George, what we need to do in October of 2009, it's going to be the 40th anniversary of all this, which I can't believe. We need to really do one of those super shows on that, and we'll have fun with it.
Absolutely. Maybe we'll get Billy Gibbons in and have him bring
Billy would have fun with it, wouldn't he?
He would. I'd like, you know what? I'd love Billy and you to co-host with me as your window dressing some kind of a in-depth, coast-to-coast type music rock interview show for one night. I think you'd have a kick doing that, and so would Billy.
Oh, I would love to do it. It would be a blast for me.
I bet Billy could bring in all kinds of people.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think we'd have a great time, and I think the listeners would love it.
There you go. Let's go to our international line, Tanya in Vancouver, Canada, where I'll be in February. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. My question is, when was the first time the phrase used, Elvis has left the building?
Excuse me, the phrase? Again, I couldn't hear.
Elvis has left the building?
Yeah, how did that start?
Okay, my phone must be cutting out, George. Could you tell me what it was again?
Yeah. How did the phrase Elvis has left the building?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Well, basically what it was is when he performed, people would not let him go. You know, when you go to a concert and people are there stamping their feet, lighting lighters, demanding an encore over and over. Well, Elvis was tired. So when he left, he got in his limo and he had someone come up and they'd say, Elvis has left the building. Which means no encore, don't stay here any longer, we've turned the lights on, it's time to go home. So that's how it started.
All right, I like it. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with our Gary Patterson right here on Coast to Coast Day Out. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, that's right, Friday night in the Saturday morning open lines. When we come right back, though, let's take your final calls with Gary Patterson right here on Coast to Coast Day Out. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our Gary Patterson, your final phone calls as well. Who's your favorite musician, Gary?
Oh, my gosh.
I keep throwing these things at you, don't I?
I know. I mean, it's like time periods. People ask me, what's your favorite album? And I'm sitting there, well, you want live albums or that? You know, when I think of favorite musicians, I mean, the Beatles were way ahead of anything when they performed. And when I talk about a single musician, I mean, Jimi Hendrix did so much with the guitar in such a short time that they just revolutionized everything. And then I think about Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin, you know, so, and how everything changed. Those guys usually struck me you know, as innovators, something that really appealed to me and made me want to play the guitar. And I bet Billy Gibbons would probably say the same thing, you know. And that was the thing. So I can listen to that. It never gets old, and it never sounds dated.
Let's go to Youngstown, Arizona, west of the Rockies. There you go. Hey, hi there, John.
How are you doing, George? Hi, Gary.
Good. Hey, John. How are you?
Gary, I have a question for you about Elvis Presley, and I want to know why they never gave him credit for keeping both them band members year after year. They went right with the times. They went right with Elvis. And how come no one ever talks about his band members?
Well, you know, when I think of Elvis, I think of Scotty Moore. I think of the Sun guys with Bill Black, DJ Fontana. Those guys were fabulous. And, you know, when I heard Elvis, you know, a lot of people say, man, when I heard Elvis, I wanted to be Elvis. No, when I heard Elvis, I wanted to be Scotty Moore. I loved the way he played guitar. I mean, it just really was amazing. And when he lost that band, he put his other bands together. I mean, my gosh, what musicians toured with him. But you got to ask yourself this. I mean, who wouldn't want to go on the road with Elvis? I mean, he treated everybody so graciously, and they were paid so well. And, you know, sometimes being the architect of a great sound, you know, you don't get enough credit. I mean, I think of Delaney and Bonnie. You're familiar with them.
Yes.
And they put a heck of a band together. And what happened to their band? They go on the road with Leon Russell, and they do the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour with Joe Cocker. And then when they come back, Eric Clapton takes the band, and it becomes Derek and the Dominoes. So they have to go out and try other musicians. But, I mean, I think it's a great talent to be able to listen to someone and put the chemistry together that makes the music so fascinating. And that's exactly how Elvis lasted through the 70s. The band was fabulous, and he could afford to be off a little because he had so many guys backing him up. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I'd like to see someone someday write and talk about more of Elvis's band members. I'd be interested in even reading anything like that because I know nothing about them.
Well, that would be a great source of all these Elvis historians out there. This would be a great topic, wouldn't it?
Elvis was the kind of guy when he went out, when he was on tour, or back in Memphis, he stayed home a lot, didn't he? Or he stayed in his hotel room.
Well, I think that, you know, Elvis had a situation in Memphis where he couldn't walk out amongst people because people would go crazy to see him. And they'd try to touch him or try to rip a shirt. That's why he would rent carnivals at night, so that he could go in with his friends. And when he went to a movie, he would go in and he'd rent the whole movie theater after midnight, and he'd bring his friends in so they could have private screenings. I think that he was a private person with that, but he was really loyal to his fans. I know that another movie Elvis was really obsessed with was Rebel Without a Cause, and he always wanted to either do the James Dean story because he really admired him or to redo the movie. And when he met Natalie Wood in Hollywood, he started to date her for a while. She came back to Memphis, and she used to say, you know, I never met anybody who was such a Boy Scout. We'd come back on his motorcycle, and here's Elvis, who's supposed to be this rebel. And he'd say, Natalie, go down to the fence and sign autographs. And he'd bring her down, and they'd sign autographs for all the fans. Now, that's really caring for something, but enjoying your privacy, too, within the gates.
Well, you know, you have to give back. And, I give a lot of speaking engagements around the country now. And, you know, producer Tom handles the arrangements. And I was at an event once. We were at a banquet, and everyone sat down to dinner before we gave speeches. And, you know, Gary, I'm that kind of person where I'll sign autographs, pose for pictures. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just if that's what they want, that's what they want. In some cases, I've talked to husband and wives and mothers on cell phones when they couldn't come. Somebody would come up to me, for example, and say, God, my mother couldn't make it. She loves Coast to Coast. And I said, call her up. And I would talk to her. But there was one night we were all having dinner at these round banquet tables. And Tom's on my right, and a couple other speakers are on my left. And someone, one of our listeners, comes up to me, and he had bought a ticket. And he said, hey, George, can I talk with you? And we're all sitting down eating. You know, I'm ready to talk to him a little bit, but Tom says, well, sir, you know, let us finish here, and then, you know, George will talk to you right after dinner. And he went, okay, great. So he stands right behind me, folds his arms, and doesn't leave until we're done eating. I mean, you talk about just weird. It was strange. So I can imagine on that very small level, what Elvis feels like and felt like on a massive level when he went out.
I mean, that's true. And, you know, you talk about funny times with that. I remember I was signing books in Nashville, Tennessee, and there were a lot of people in line. I was signing books because I wanted to be gracious and sign pictures, whatever. And this guy dressed in black came up to me, and he said, "Gary, would you sign your book for me?" And I looked up at him, and it was Carl Perkins. And, you know, I said, "My gosh, here I am signing a book for Carl Perkins." And I said, "Carl, I'll sign the book for you, but you have to sign your book for me." And I just had bought his book called Go Cat Go, and he signed it for me. He said, "To Gary, from your friend Carl Perkins." Then he wrote,
"Isn't that
Go
cool?
Cat Go" at the bottom of it, and I treasure that. That's wonderful.
Jerry in Arkansas, first-time caller. You're on with Gary Patterson. Jerry.
Good evening, fellas.
Hi.
I was wondering, I'm probably fixing to make some Elvis fans mad out there, but
here we go.
There's no denying his talent. Absolutely not. And the way he brought the music to the people is just, I don't think anyone else could have done it. But to me, Chuck Berry will always be the king because he wrote his own songs, number one. But maybe more importantly, I think Colonel Parker was the devil. I think Elvis allowed himself to be manipulated. And
you might be right about that.
Squandered all through the 60s. And when I think of the great music that he could have been made, mm-hmm. making in the 60s, and the directions that he might have gone if he had been allowed to be an artist, mm-hmm. rather than a cash cow for, like, this carnival barker snake oil salesman,
it just right
makes
there.
Me sad when I think about what could have been. And I was just wondering what your guess thought about that
okay.
point of view.
I think it's interesting. You know, the one thing that goes through my mind when you said is Colonel Parker is the devil. You know, Elvis and Robert Johnson died on August 16th. Of course, Johnson was in probably close to the year Elvis was born. And there's a legend about Robert Johnson selling his soul to the devil at a crossroads. I think in your statement, Elvis must have sold his to Colonel Tom Parker for his fame.
He could have.
And, you know, that's something that's kind of interesting because he wasn't allowed to change with the time. And when he got out of the Army, when he came back, he was more like doing the movies. He was more like young Dean Martin Elvis instead of the Elvis who did Jailhouse Rock. And that's what was so important in 1968 when he came and reclaimed his throne. I mean, I loved to have seen that in 68 when I watched it. But it was just something so important with it.
Did Chuck Berry come before Elvis?
I think Chuck Berry is very close to Elvis. Little Richard came before Chuck Berry. When you listen to Tutti Frutti and Good Golly Miss Molly, I mean, Little Richard, to me, probably deserves the title of the King of Rock and Roll. Because, George, every time I listen to Little Richard, I have a smile on my face. I mean, my foot taps, and it's great music. And Chuck Berry took the guitar to another level, probably the first really great guitarist, with incredible lyrics who could sum up the whole essence of rock and roll, which is, you know, well, school day's over, let's go home, let's dance, let's do this. And it appealed to a whole generation of teenagers. And, of course, Elvis, you know, and he was the visual image of rock and roll. And one of the things that really got me, I did a film for Russian television company, and they were telling me how much they loved rock and roll and how rock and roll actually had brought down the Soviet Union because as teenagers they hid their albums that were blacklisted. They're not supposed to have them, but they did. So all this money we spent on missiles pointed toward the Soviet Union in the 50s, all we needed was the gyrating hips of Elvis Presley, the piano riffs of Little Richard, and the duck walk of Chuck Berry. We broke it, you know, forever after that.
Somewhere, someplace, in one of my boxes, I've got Chuck Berry's home number.
Chuck is an interesting person.
I just can't find the phone number. Let's go to Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Kat, you're on the air with us.
Hi, glad to talk to you. I've always been mystified by the fact that Elvis Presley was supposed to have a twin brother that died in the womb and was never born.
Jesse Garant.
Is that a true story, right, Gary?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, a lot of people, some of the books that come out about Elvis being alive is that actually takes the name Jesse now in honor of his dead twin. And that was one thing that sort of, I don't know, I don't know if it's a mystical thing saying that the twin died and Elvis inherited both of their life energies or whatever. I mean, I've heard all this. But it is true that he did have a twin. And Elvis's name was Elvis Aaron, and the other twin's name was Jesse Garant.
Yeah, I just always heard he had a twin and everything, and that the twin identity really kind of messed up his life and everything because he, I mean, just he, I think he just
I've heard that he like grieved over that his entire life, that his twin died.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it also made his mother much more closer to him because she had lost one. And Elvis was her child. And, you know, she was so tight and emotional with him and so fearing of letting him go. And, of course, Elvis was devastated when his mother died. I mean, he was in the Army. And the story goes that when Vernon called him, he was asleep, and as soon as he heard the phone, he said, "My mother's dead," which is, you know, which was rather incredible. Another thing is his mother died in August, if I remember correctly, and she died on August 14th in 1958, I believe, and Elvis died on August 16th in 1977. So I guess, you know, T.S. Eliot always says April is the cruelest month. I think for Elvis it was August was the cruelest month.
Yeah, maybe so. 42 was not old.
Not old at all. Of course, in 1977, I might have disagreed at the time, but after you hit it, it's not old at all.
West of the Rockies, Peter, you're on with us. Hi, Pete.
Hi, George.
Good to have you with us. Go ahead, Pete.
It's great to talk to you guys. Hey, I just wanted to share a real neat story with you.
Sure.
When I was 8 years old, my dad was stationed in Bad Nauheim, Germany, when Elvis was in the military.
Oh, that's great.
And my dad was his platoon sergeant. So I was a child of 7 or 8 years old. I saw him on a regular basis. And I threw football around with him, and he came over to the apartment for drinks and dinner one night. And my mom did a lot of his fan mail for him because he was still quite busy.
What a wonderful story.
The ironic thing about this, back in the 70s when I was in the military, I was heading back from Fresno to Fort McClellan, Alabama, and I was going through Mississippi, and I come through Tupelo, and I go, I'll be darned, this is Elvis's, this is where it all started. And about the time, the radio station interrupted, stating that he had passed away.
Wow.
And I got a chill right up my back, pulled the car over, just sat there stunned. I couldn't believe the irony in that whole full circle of my association with him, and then me being in his hometown when he passed. So I thought I'd just share that with you guys.
Well, thanks for sharing. That's a wonderful story.
Hey, Pete, did you like him? Was he a good guy?
You know, he was a heck of a guy. He, you know, I was more into comic books and Marvel, so I wasn't really, you know, that fascinated with him. But he would be at the company shining his boots. He was a tank driver, and he would be out in the motor pool washing his tank. And, you know, it's funny, years later in the 80s, a work associate of mine at Madera, at the county jail where I work, came across some 17 magazines. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah.
They were written for young teenage girls back in the 50s.
Yes.
She come across an article about Elvis and a lot of photo shoots of him in Germany, standing in the mess hall and out by his tank and stuff. And so she gave it to me. I took it home to my dad. And my dad wasn't in any of the pictures, but right away he starts looking at him, naming off all these people that Elvis was standing by, you know. So it was pretty cool. And so what? I have, you know, he was a heck of a guy. He was a super friendly guy and easy to approach. And he was like one of the other guys. He did everything everybody else did. He didn't get any special favors when he was on duty. So it was pretty neat.
Did your dad ever have, hey, Pete, did your father ever have an Elvis story?
No, you never really talked about it a lot, other than, don't you remember, he said, son, you went over to his apartment off base, because he lived in apartments off base. He said, hey, you used to go over there and throw the football with him out in the street, and well, I didn't remember that, you know, and he said, yeah, and he came up to the apartment one night, and you had a back when the slot car racetracks came out. Elvis came into your room and with some of the guys, and they were, you never got to play with it because those guys are so into it. And then I think one of the guys spilled their drink on my racetrack and shorted it out. So I never did get to play the darn thing. But, you know, it was just, it was kind of neat. And when he came to Fresno, just I think it was 72 or 73, I don't remember the year. This guy had a memory you would not believe. A limo pulls up to the front of the house, and the driver gets out and gives my mother a package of tickets. I think there were 8 tickets to Selma Arena to see Elvis in concert, because he remembered my dad's hometown, and he found, you know, I guess he had a way of finding the address and stuff. And so my mom took all my aunts and uncles, and they went to the concert and got backstage passes. And She rehashed some old times from the 50s, so it was pretty neat.
That's great. Thanks, Pete. Do you remember those slot cars, Gary? They never stayed on the track.
No, but
so
went
frustrating.
Through that curve. That's where you lost it. But boy,
all
they
the
were
time.
Fun, weren't they?
Have they developed these things to a point now where they stay on the track?
Well, I haven't seen those in a while, but when my little nephews were growing up, I noticed that they seemed to last a lot better than what we had, so I think they did.
Next time you're in L.A., let's go buy one and have some kind of contest or something.
Hey, that'd be great. Let's do it.
You take a car,
Dead
Tom will take
curve.
One.
We'll,
hey,
do, it,
we'll
yeah.
do it. We'll just have our own races. East of the Rockies, John in Memphis, Tennessee. We've got a few minutes. Go ahead, John.
Great show, gentlemen. I love this show.
Thank you.
I guess my time was more or less, I was always fascinated with the Led Zeppelin stories.
Uh-huh.
Jimmy Page and Robert Plant and his son dying and Jimmy Page being apparently wrapped up with the Aleister Crowley living in his house or something like that. I don't know how much truth that was to that, but I read on that stuff. I guess my main question is, because I ain't heard too much about Hutchinson. You know the guy from NXS singer?
Yeah.
Is there any stories at all?
Well, you know,
apparently he killed himself or something like that. I know he was having trouble with his wife and could never see his daughter. I don't know if he'd ever heard anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his daughter's name was Tiger Lily. And Paula Yates was the girl he was dating, but she was already married. And he was having trouble with her ex-husband. The guy who did Live Aid and Slipping, not Live Aid, but now I think it was Live Aid England. He was given a title. But anyway, it was her husband, and he was despondent because he couldn't be with them. And then they found his body hanging in, I think, the bathroom or in a closet in Australia. And I think the thing of his death was an open verdict. They probably thought, his father says it was definitely not suicide. It was more maybe accidental.
Was that Bob Geldof?
Yeah, Bob Geldof, exactly. Thank you. And that was the thing. You know, it was, I think it's still an open verdict. We don't know. He was depressed, but his father says he never would have killed himself. So it could have been an accidental thing. There's all kinds of rumors on it online, so it's kind of fun to maybe research it. But, you know, he was just a fabulous talent who died too early, which is the sad common theme of rock and roll.
Yeah, it sure is. Gary, my friend, thank you for spending the whole night with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, George, this goes too fast. We had a great time. This was fun.
It really does. Our Gary Patterson for Kara Scoburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy and Punnett, Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.